The book of 1 Timothy is written by Paul to a guy named Timothy. And Timothy is working with the church in Ephesus, and Timothy has some struggles there in Ephesus. The church there is not doing particularly well. It seems like there are some concerns about false teachers. There are concerns possibly even about elders who are engaged in some of that. As you read through this letter, you see a strong emphasis on maintaining the truth of God's word. You see a strong emphasis on having good, righteous, quality elders and leaders. And you also see some guidance on how to actually approach an elder who is not being faithful and who might even need be in need of rebuke. One of the things that I consider to be a great honor and blessing is that in my time here with the Maryville Church of Christ, I have grown tremendously in my appreciation and in my love for this church and for the eldership that we have here. I think we have a fantastic eldership. I think we have tremendous leadership. And I think that there is, if you've been to many other churches, you'll know that's actually not the most common thing in the world, to have a really strong and solid eldership. And as a minister, there's like nothing that makes my life better and easier and more pleasant than having a good, strong, solid eldership. And so when I think of blessings in my life, I think of this church and I think of our leadership, and that's something that means a whole lot to me. But as I read through 1 Timothy, I think, man, that would be a tough situation to be in, because Timothy's not like from Ephesus. He's a younger guy. He's sent to a major city, and he's sent to a church that has a lot of issues. And so this is a letter of strong encouragement and of hope. It's a letter where Paul is urging him to remain faithful, to remain committed to his message and to his ministry. And it's a letter where Paul is instructing him on what actually will be helpful for the church. Like, what should the church be doing? And so whenever we read the book of 1 Timothy, I think that's an important question for us to ask. Like, what should the church be doing? How should we conduct ourselves as people who are part of God's church? How should we live? I think it's an important question. And I think the answer that Paul gives, he gives a lot of specifics about different situations. He talks about, for example, how to handle a false teacher. He talks about how to make sure you have good leadership, how to make sure you have good deacons and good elders. He talks about how to make sure that the rich people don't dominate and take over the church. He talks about how to make sure that widows who might not have people to take care of them, how to make sure they're cared for and provided for by the church. He talks about a whole lot of things, how the church should prioritize and take seriously the discipline of prayer. And like, you read through it and you see all sorts of topics covered for how the church ought to conduct itself. But all of that is grounded and is rooted in the truth of who Jesus is, or what Paul calls the mystery of godliness. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 14 through 16, if you have your Bibles, please turn there. Paul uses this phrase, the mystery of godliness. And we're going to talk about that phrase a little bit, but then he actually gives this beautiful six-line early Christian confession of what that mystery is. It's revealed to us. It's made manifest to us in Jesus Christ. And I think that that's something that no matter what church you're a part of, whether things are going really, really well or whether things are going poorly, whether you are in Ephesus or whether you're in Corinth, whether you're in Maryville, Tennessee, or whether you're any number of the places that we support in our mission work, this mystery of godliness is something that all churches need. It's something that all Christians need, and it's something that we should ground our lives and our faith in. And so I think it's a wonderful passage that we're going to study this morning. It's actually one of those really important passages where Paul, in the middle of writing this letter, he stops and he actually tells us, this is why I'm writing this whole thing. So everything that I just said about like why he's writing it, I'm kind of pulling that from Paul. Sometimes when you're reading a letter, it's kind of hard to figure out, like, what is causing this? You know, most of the letters that we read in the New Testament, we call them occasional, meaning there is some occasion that emerges in a church, some situation, and then Paul has to, like, address that situation. And so you're trying to figure out, okay, so what is it that he's writing this for? What is the reason for it? And that helps you read the whole thing once you kind of know that. Well, here he explicitly says, I am writing these things to you so that. So Paul has sent Timothy to Ephesus. Paul's gone. He's not in Ephesus. And he's hoping to come and visit him. But notice these words. This is chapter 3 and verse 14. I am writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I'm delayed, I'm writing so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. So he says, basically, there are some things I want to tell you. I'm hoping to see you pretty soon, but I'm out traveling doing my work. It might be a while before I see you. So I'm going to write you a letter with all the stuff that I would tell you. And this is how you're supposed to conduct yourself as a church. Like, this is how you're supposed to live. And that's why whenever you're reading things about false teachers or about prayer or about leadership or about godliness or widows and making sure people are fed and taken care of and provided for and wealth, like all of these different topics that he gives are things to help the church address these different issues that pop up. And so that's why he's writing the letters, like to help him know how to conduct all of these different situations. But as he does so, he uses some really interesting language and terminology. Keep in mind, he is writing to the church in Ephesus. This right here is a reconstruction. I think this is actually in Istanbul, but it's a reconstruction of a temple that was in Ephesus, the temple of Artemis the Great. And this temple, sometimes it's referred to as like one of the seven great wonders of the ancient world, but this temple is one of the most impressive feats of ancient construction ever realized. It is. It has 127 pillars in it. And each one of them is over 60 feet tall. Not only that, as you like stretch the thing out lengthwise, it's longer than a football field, including the end zones. Like if you include from the end of this end zone all the way through, the temple goes even longer than that. It's also wider than a football field. The thing is entirely made out of marble, and it was made hundreds of years before Jesus. It's truly a remarkable structure, a remarkable temple. And not only that, it was filled with some of the best sculptures from some of the most talented artists and sculptors that were alive. And it would be like a tremendous honor to have your sculpture put in such a magnificent temple. But this is something that was known throughout the ancient world. People would travel to come see it. People would worship the gods there. And it was ultimately the temple of Artemis, who was the chief goddess of the city of Ephesus. So really impressive building, really impressive temple. And when Paul describes the purpose of this letter, he uses a lot of language that I think would have made the people living there who see this temple every day, it would have reminded them of what the church actually is and how valuable the church is. For example, when he says, I am writing these things to you that you may know how to conduct yourself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and buttress of truth. All of these descriptions are going to make us think of some sort of great temple. For example, household of God or the house of God, that's common temple language in the Bible. It's also family language, like your family or the people within your household. And so it's a great honor to be considered part of God's actual household. Like we're part of his family. And by the way, God being the head of the household, he's the one who gets to make the rules for his household. So when it says how you ought to conduct yourself, like when you're in someone's house, you should follow the rules for that house. You should honor the person who's in charge of it, and you should try to do things their way. There's a certain way a house is supposed to be run. And so I think that's an important idea for the book of 1 Timothy. He's giving us the way that God's house is run. And if you're invited into his house as the church, that's what you're invited into. You get to become part of God's household. There's a way you ought to live in God's household. But household of God is also temple language. Like, what is God's house in the Bible? It's the temple. Now, we would think of the temple in Jerusalem, but if they were to ask, what about Artemis? Well, that's her house. Like, this is great temple where the goddess lives. And so when you're talking about the household of God, I think there's a contrast that Paul is trying to illuminate between what they might think of as the household of God, like the big, beautiful structure, magnificent, shining in the sunlight, tall, long, wide, filled with the greatest artwork, or this small gathering of people who come together early on the first day of the week under cover of darkness. And you realize, like, which one is God really present in? Paul is saying, actually, it's you guys. You're the household of God. It's not the great, magnificent building. What you guys are doing is actually where the presence of God lives. It's a subversive message. but it's also an encouraging and powerful message. He then calls it the church of the living God. And that's a really important distinction also, because all of those sculptures that are in the Temple of Artemis, those are not living gods. Those are dead gods. Those are gods of stone and wood. Those are lifeless gods that don't speak, that don't think, and that don't act. What he's saying is when you guys are gathered together, you are actually the assembly of the living God, the God who is true and alive, the God who is life-giving and powerful, the God who is worshiped and receives that worship, and the God who blesses his people, like the God who is active and real. That's who you are. That's why your gathering, even though you don't have a big, fancy, magnificent building, your gathering of the church under cloak of darkness, that is where the true living God actually resides, not in some big, glorious temple. As a matter of fact, that final phrase he uses, where he calls the church the pillar and support, or the pillar and the buttress of truth, I mean, that's what those 127 pillars are. Like, they're holding up falsehood. They're holding up a false god. They're holding up something beautiful, something impressive, something magnificent, but they're not actually holding up truth. When the church gathers in the presence of God and proclaims the truth of God, that is a more powerful and sacred moment than anything you can find anywhere else in this world. And by the way, that's something we're actually doing here right now. We've gathered together. We have proclaimed words of truth. Truth that have stemmed back for thousands of years. Truth that is eternal. Truth that originates with God. God is in our midst and is present among us. And he's the living God. He's not the God who existed a long time ago and died and is irrelevant to our lives. He's not a lifeless idol. We are in the presence of the living God holding up and supporting his truth. And as we do so, I think we serve a more valuable function to God's view of the world than anything else that's accomplished anywhere. There is no assembly that is more important for the cosmos than when the church gathers in the proclamation of the Lordship of Jesus. That matters. That's eternally significant and important. And there's no building or there's no structure anywhere in the world that competes or compares. And so I think it's important that when we recognize what we're doing, it might look small sometimes. I imagine the church in Ephesus gathering together. It didn't look like the most impressive gathering of people. But what it was a coming together of the living God's assembly. And that is something that matters. And that is something that is important. That is something that is eternal. That is something that is true and sure. And so Paul encourages the church by reminding them, you are the household of God. You are the assembly of the living God. You are the pillar and support of God's truth in this world. And if you were going to summarize, what is the grounding truth upon which all the other things Paul writes is built? So I mentioned, Paul talks about a bunch of different topics in here, about teachers and prayer and leadership in the church and helping widows and godliness and wealth and rebuking elders and like all of these different topics. But there are fundamental truths that all of those are grounded in. What I mean is, none of those things by themselves is the center of our faith. Those are all offshoots of the center of our faith. The center of what we do and believe is grounded and rooted in Jesus. If there was no Jesus, then it doesn't really matter who your eldership is, right? If there is no Jesus, then I don't think it really cares too much whether a person's teaching truth or falsehood about him. He doesn't even exist. If there's no Jesus, then like none of these other things really have any significance or purpose to them. And so Paul wants to ground all that we do as a church in the person of Jesus and in the story of Jesus and in the reality of Jesus. And it's that story and person and reality. It's what Jesus has done in our world that he calls the mystery of godliness, which is why in verse 16, Paul says, great, right after saying you are the household of God, the church of the living God, the pillar and support of truth, he says, great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness. This is a common confession. What we're about to read here is actually something that the early church would confess with one another about what ultimately matters most. We're about to read and discuss an ancient Christian confession about the mystery of godliness in the world that was revealed to us. When Paul uses the word mystery, he's not using it in the way that like we might read like a mystery novel or something like that, like something you can't quite figure out. When he uses the word mystery, he uses it a couple of occasions. In fact, he uses it just earlier in this very context, talking about deacons, talking about people who hold to the mystery of the faith. But he uses the word to describe that which cannot be known except it is revealed by God. Like there are certain things that would be mysterious to us, but that God has revealed and made known. He's manifest those things to us. And so there are things that are beyond human knowledge and comprehension, but that we can now know and have certainty of. Why? Because those were the mysteries of God revealed to us. And when you're talking about the mystery of godliness, you're talking about the mystery of what God is doing in our world and what God is calling us to be. And so when he discusses this great early confession of the mystery of godliness, he actually gives us this like short poem. It's probably something that Paul didn't just invent right here, but is something that he is using to teach the church was already familiar with, like probably something they were already saying. It's written in poetic structure, and it's something that he seems to believe they're already familiar with. And he says, this is the mystery of godliness that we confess. And then he describes it. It's all about Jesus. He says, he was manifest in the flesh. Manifest, that's the word that means like he was made known and revealed to us in the flesh. Some translations will say God was manifest in the flesh right here. I think probably, like manuscript-wise, he or who was, is a better translation of that. But I do think that's the idea of it, is that God, who is the great mystery, was revealed to us in the flesh of Jesus. And that is the story of the incarnation. That's a story of Jesus becoming a human being and living in this life. And in so doing, the mystery, which is something kind of hidden, is manifest. It's made known and revealed to us. And so we get to see and learn about and participate in this great mystery through the incarnation of Jesus. It says, vindicated by the Spirit is the next line that Paul uses. That's likely a reference to his resurrection. So it's a good feeling to be vindicated. You ever say something and people doubt you and you're having an argument maybe and you're saying your fact and they're saying, no, that's completely wrong. And then you go to Google and Google confirms the truth on which you had been standing and you are vindicated. You are proven to be right, even though they are proven to be wrong. In many ways, the resurrection was a vindication of all that Jesus said and did. And it was vindicated by the power of the resurrection through the Spirit of God. Is he the Messiah? Is he the Son of God? Does death have power over him? In all of these ways, people might think, well, the cross ended his ministry. No, it did not. He was vindicated through the resurrection by the Spirit. People might think, well, yeah, he might claim to be the Son of God, but sons of God don't get nailed to crosses and die in shame and agony. Apparently they do. And they rise victoriously over it. Like even the power of death and darkness itself could not hold him captive. He was vindicated. His ministry and identity were vindicated by the Spirit and what he did. That is the truth upon which our faith is grounded. That when he says we are the pillar and support of the truth, I think these are the truths that he's getting at. The truths that have transformed our world. He says he was seen by angels. That's a really interesting phrase right there, because I think it could indicate one of two things, or maybe more things, but on the one hand, it could indicate the cosmic supernatural scope of what Jesus has done, in that he was seen not only by human eyes, but seen by angelic eyes also. Like, even in the unseen, invisible realm, what Jesus did was profoundly shaping reality in changing the nature of creation, changing the nature of reality itself, right? He was seen even by angels. But also, that word angels, it does sometimes refer to humans. So in the, angelos is a Greek word, or angeloi, plural. And sometimes it's about spiritual beings, but the very literal meaning of it is just a messenger. And so sometimes when God sends like a heavenly messenger to earth, we call it an angel. But also, sometimes just humans are called angels when they're messengers. John the Baptist is called an angel. It's also just used for humans sometimes. And so this might be a way of referring to like the witnesses who saw Jesus and then went out and proclaimed it. Like they saw the resurrection of Jesus, the apostles, for example, they saw the resurrection of Jesus and they became messengers of that resurrection, the ones who were sent out with the message of Christ. Because the next line is proclaimed among the nations. And so if we're kind of going in order, it might make sense that he was manifest in the flesh, vindicated through the resurrection in the spirit. He was seen by his messengers and then proclaimed throughout the world by those messengers. And they, you can read, you know, about what Paul has done and the missionary journeys and all these things. I think that word nations is also really relevant, because the word nations is also in Greek the exact same word as Gentiles. And it's a way of saying the Jewish Messiah is not for one people only or only for the Jews, but he and his lordship is actually proclaimed throughout the whole earth, even among all of the nations, among Jews and Gentiles also. And so the truth that the church stands upon is proclaimed throughout the world, but not only is it proclaimed, it is also believed on in the world. This is really radical also, because there was remarkable and surprising success with the preaching of the message of the gospel. So it's hard to like say anything and convince masses of people from different countries and different languages that you are right. Even when you are right, that's really hard to do. Even when they like the message, that's not always easy to get people to like radically change their lives because of something you're saying. But with the message of Jesus, the success of it is mind-blowing. Because not only was it believed on throughout the world, like Paul's writing to Ephesus. Why in the world does Ephesus care about a Jewish Messiah that was living 30 years earlier and was crucified? Like, why would they care? But all of a sudden, there's this community of people gathering together and worshiping him as God. Like, the fact that Jesus is proclaimed as a God is a radical idea in the ancient world, especially because he was crucified. And, I mean, think of the message. Like, Paul describes the difficulty of it when he says, to Jews it's a stumbling block, and to Greeks it's foolishness. But to those of us who were called, it is the message of God, and it is the wisdom of God and the power of God. Like, when you proclaim a message that says, hey, I want you to abandon the religious convictions that you've held and abandon all the gods of the cities you've lived in and ignore that big, huge, glorious temple over there. That is a false temple. And I want you to become part of this small community of people who are proclaiming the lordship of Jesus in our midst. And this is where the presence of God is. That's a hard message to sell. People can look at your little group and they can look at the huge temples and the glorious statues and what almost everyone else is doing. It's going to be easier just to go with the crowd. Especially when you say, and by the way, the God that we serve, he was crucified by the Romans and they killed him. And not only that, if you come follow us, you might be too. You are putting your life on the line by joining this. Like, that's the easiest message in the world to say no to. And yet surprisingly, a lot of people didn't. Surprisingly, here we are 2,000 years later on the other side of the world still proclaiming the mystery of godliness. We're still uttering this early confession that the church maintained as that which it was the pillar and support of, that which it tried to hold up and proclaim to the ancient world. He ends it by saying, taken up in glory. So you can't read this completely chronologically. Sometimes the ascension of Jesus is, in different biblical stories is spoken of as a climactic moment, even though it's not always place like chronologically at the beginning. But here, I love how it's like he's made manifest in the flesh, vindicated through the Spirit, and then he was seen, proclaimed, believed, and then it concludes with the scene of him rising up. We actually just sang about the ascension, which I loved it when we sang about it. We saw thee not, and we discussed his beheld that journey to the skies. It's like, that's a huge moment in early Christianity. And when we think about key gospel movements, I think that's one that sometimes gets a little bit neglected. We focus a lot more on the death and the burial and the resurrection and that. But it really is significant that he ascended, because that's when he takes his seat at the throne. Like, that's the enthronement picture. It's a greater ascension to a throne than any king of Israel or any emperor of Rome. He sits on a grander, more real, more cosmic, universal throne, exalted into the heavens, over and above anyone else. That's what it means that he was taken up in glory. He has a glorious throne with which no throne competes at all. So when you think about this great mystery of godliness, there's something interesting about the temple of Artemis that we were talking about. If you go to visit the temple of Artemis today, you might be a little disappointed, because it's not there. As beautiful as it was, as grand as it was, as much time and effort and beauty went into it, It's been destroyed, and it's in ruins. Like, it's not what it once was. And yet here we are, still holding up the pillar and support of God's truth, still proclaiming a message that has not died out. The world has changed. Governments have changed. You've had different philosophies that have dominated mankind. And yet you still see people throughout the world holding to and proclaiming this message, this mystery. And that's something that is an honor and a privilege to be a part of and to join in. And so when you think of your life as a Christian, recognize that you're part of something so much bigger than yourself. You're part of something so much bigger than a whim or a desire or any particular ministry or any particular issue that might arise in a congregation. And sometimes we can blow things out of proportion that every small thing becomes this major thing that's got. Recognize how grand and widespread and enduring the message of the faith is, the mystery of godliness is, and put your hope in that. It's bigger than any other thing that we do, and it's more enduring than any other thing that we do. So as we bring our lesson to a close, I want you guys to support the mission of this church and of the church throughout the world, the church throughout the last 2,000 years, by regularly remembering and confessing the central truths of the faith like this. Remember and confess how important it is that he was manifest in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, and taken up in glory. Make that a regular part of your spiritual devotion, your prayer life, your worship life. And if there's anyone here who wants to join in that story, join in that mystery, to become one with who Jesus is and what he has done, please let that be known. You can confess him as the Lord of your life, as the King of your life, the King of all the earth. You can have your sins washed away in baptism, living a life for him from this point forward. You can talk to some of our elders in the library in the back, or if you want to, you can come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.